So I said before, this morning I would like us to discuss what could be called a high altitude meditation. Okay. There are not a lot of people at the top of the mountain, right? Yeah. There are no paths up there. It's pretty simple. You know, there's the top of the mountain. You know, there's stones and some little critters and grass and stuff. There's no Doctor Strange, crazy stuff. It's just pretty simple and ordinary. And the view is breathtaking. Down the mountain, there are lots of people and lots of paths. And there are gorgeous views and there are not so gorgeous views. And there's a whole lot that can be said about all that. But at high altitudes, it's really hard to know what to say. It's sort of like if I wanted to talk about a gorgeous sunset. What can I say about it? Well, the sun is sitting on the horizon, yeah. And it's dark some places and light others and lots of colors, yeah. Maybe you just ought to go take a look, And you go over it and you look and you say, oh, wow. And fall silent. Similarly, at high altitudes, it's breathtaking. And it's really difficult to talk about what's going on. So rather than just talk about the top of the mountain, what I thought we could do is talk about what I like to call the spectrum of awareness. The spectrum of awareness includes everything that's possible for us to experience, everything. And at one of the end of the spectrum are the more obvious, thicker experiences that are hard to avoid. And as you go across the spectrum, as you travel across that, it's sort of like going up the mountain. And so at the other end of the spectrum, oh, we've got it up there. Great. At the other end of the spectrum are the most refined and most elusive experiences. As it turns out, though, that anything that we can experience is actually available right in this moment, right now. It truly is. It's that the only problem is that, too often we're distracted, but it's actually right here. So let's come at this from a slightly different angle. How many of you have been meditating regularly, and by regular I mean on average, 5 or 6 times a week for a year or longer? Okay, 2 years? 3? 5? 10? 20? 35? I'm all alone. I've been sitting for 50 years. Yes, I did my first 2-week retreat at Insight Meditation Society back in the early 70s with Ruth Dennison. I had no idea who she was. And I was totally unprepared. And I left that retreat, and on the way out, I thought, this is the most wonderful thing in my whole life that I have ever done. And I'm sure glad I'll never have to do that again. But I went back the next year and the next, and I've done 1 or 2 retreats, ever since then. I do not think that it's possible to meditate regularly for more than a year or two without getting a taste of high altitude meditation. Without getting just a bit of the flavor. The experience may be so fleeting that it just doesn't register consciously. But somewhere inside our system, it registers. I mean, why else would anybody keep meditating day after day, week after week, month after month? You know, unless somewhere inside there, you may not even be able to put your finger on it, but somewhere inside there, you've got an inkling, you know, of what it's like at the top. So if you meditate for social prestige, spiritual bravado, you know, wears out pretty quick. If we don't know how to recognize those rarefied experiences, you know, it can get discouraging at times. It truly can. But somewhere inside, it registers, and there's a trace that remains. So, for example, right now, as we sit here, so I'm talking, and you're listening, and I bet there's more going on in your mind than hearing my words, right? There are images and flashes and parts of the day and stuff that's carried through there. So all that stuff going on. Back behind all of that, you just imagine dropping back behind all that. Can you feel a place in there that's just very still? It's quiet. And it doesn't, you know, jump up and down and yell and say, notice me, notice me, notice me. But can you feel that back there? It's there all the time. So if you want to find some peace and you go looking for it out there, it's going to be a long search. It's going to be a long search. It's not out there. It's back here, behind all this stuff that goes on. And it may not be stable. Maybe that you notice it and just goes and hides under a rock, you know, someplace. But it's there. And it's there all the time. So, as it turns out, it's not that important where we think we are on the spectrum of awareness. The only thing that's important is are we facing in the right direction? And if we're facing in the right direction, then frankly, it's just a matter of time. A little bit of patience helps. A little bit of skill helps. In fact, you know, early on, it's just meditation seemed like some magical incantation or something. I couldn't figure what was going on. But as my practice went deeper and deeper, I said, no, it's just a matter of knowing what to do with the mind. Knowing what to do with this system that we live inside, which is a whole lot less personal than we imagine. So this morning, I'd like us to talk about the spectrum of awareness and where we are and where we're headed. And again, please feel free to interrupt me, ask questions, you know, insert your own comments. I'd like to hear, it's really helpful to hear this through other people's language. Yes?
Is the experience you're talking about
what we do that, let's samadhi? Get the mic so people online can hear.
Yep.
Yeah, thank you.
So is the experience you're talking about what traditionally people would call samadhi?
Samadhi is a tricky word.
Okay.
Samadhi in the West is oftentimes translated as concentration. Mm-hmm. And in English, concentration really implies a whole lot of energy. You concentrate, you picture somebody sweating. Samadhi is probably better translated as collectedness. Collectedness. You know, and they'll use the word unification of mind, but I don't know, that sounds like an air compressor to me or something. It's not an inaccurate translation, it's just... And the way samadhi is actually cultivated, and I'll be inserting this in a lot, is actually through relaxation. My little organization, and it was the original title of my first book, but the publisher said it was too obscure. But the title is Easing Awake, to really get in that the most crucial thing, particularly in the West, as actually learning how to relax the mind without going to sleep. And if you're too tired, the best thing to do is take a nap. I mean, why fight it? Yeah. So the place that we're talking about back there, as you feel that, it doesn't actually feel like a place. The title of this book that's with my editor right now is Presence.
I don't really have a question, but just since you mentioned the title of your, or the proposed title of your first book, Easing Into Awake, and the idea of relaxation being a good at least starting point for the West particularly. I was just hoping you could talk a little bit more about that, because that's kind of where I feel my best, or my best starting place is just, you know, step one, basic foundation, relaxing. Mm-hmm. I start with my body, but that's a gateway to everything that's going on in my head. So of course, you know, walking the line between relaxation and sleepiness, but I hope that you can speak a little bit more about that, because it's just, it really resonates with me, that just relaxing, or is that being the path?
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing to work with in meditation actually is that tension. Anytime the mind wanders, part of the issue is there's too much energy there. And if you look at what the Buddha had to say about it, which he's an okay guy to check in on, probably the most central teaching, you know, in this stuff, it's called the Four Noble Truths. And it's a little bit of a misnomer. The noble doesn't refer to the truths. It refers to the mind of the person who perceives those truths. And the truths are really kind of ordinary, actually. And the first one says that there is suffering. And there's always a three-part repetition. There is suffering. Suffering is to be understood. So suffering is not something to be pushed away, to be done away with, to be offed, you know, but is to be understood. And then the third repetition, he says, and suffering has been understood by me, which is, I think, the longer phrase there. And if you want some of what I have got, this is how I got there. Then the second one says that the source of suffering is tanha, which means tension. And I'm not that great of a Pali scholar, so when I'm looking at these key words, I like to check around with scholars that I really trust to see how they translate the verb that goes with tanha. And they all translate it the same. The verb is abandon. Tension is to be abandoned. You don't mess with it. You want to understand the suffering, the tension. You don't fool around with it. You just walk away from it. How do you abandon tension? You relax. So it's right there. It's right there in the core of his teachings. In your sittings, when the mind wanders, the first thing to do is to see it, recognize it, you know? So I translate the first one in meditation as turning towards. Okay, there's a hindrance come up, the mind drifts off. You just turn your attention towards it so you can see it. And then you relax. And in English, the word relax has a little bit of aversion in it. So I like to say relax into. So my mind is spinning out. I turn towards it. I see the spinning. As we get into the spectrum of awareness, there's some refinement of that. But basically, it's to see what's to see the spinning, to turn towards it, and to relax into the spinning. Not to get away from it, but just to soften into it. And then you're not secretly trying to push something away. And over time, if you do that a lot, it starts to become habitual. You know, so a little bit of tension comes up and you just automatically go, ah. And as that gets more habitual, then the practice just gets easier and easier.
That's wonderful, thank you.
Yeah. I would also say, by the way, meditation should be fun. You know, if it's not fun, you're trying too hard. You know, so it's like learning, and because you think about it, you know, when the mind is having fun, it gets light, it gets expansive, it becomes very sensitive. You know? So a sense of humor works. Yes.
So much.
Oh, you do.
You don't need it. We need you to have it.
Hi.
Hi.
So could you talk a little bit about want and desire mm-hmm. in relation as far as the four?
For the Four Noble Truths?
Four Noble Truths. Yes,
thank you. Yeah, you know, want and desire get a lot of bad press in Buddhism, right? And we're trying to off it all the time. And so we end up, you know, disliking or wanting, which is sort of makes it worse, right? So you get aversion on top of wanting. So aversion is just wanting to not have something. So there's a couple things you can do with it. You know, one is to look at the wanting, and I would say turn towards it and relax into it. Not for the purpose of getting rid of it, but to see what's underneath it. And so you can do this little exercise. So there's wanting in the mind, so I want a new cell phone. And so I turn towards and relax into that, but it keeps on coming back up, so I need to work with a little bit more. And so what do I think I would get if I had a cell phone? Well, it would be convenient. So what would it be like if my life was more convenient? Well, there would be more space for ease. What are some other ways that I can get space and ease? I can meditate, I can be kinder to people, etc., etc. So I think within all desires and wanting, underneath all the difficulty, there's always a seed of something that's wholesome. And there may be a whole lot of garbage around it. But I don't think we're really free of it until we can see what the wholesome thing is that the mind is wanting. So my wanting a cell phone was, you know, a way of just, you know, being able to relax more. And I may get all confused about it, and that's and so it may need to work with that, you know, with some skill. But we don't get to throw anything overboard. Yes, would you like a third one now? Dale, please go ahead.
So is it accurate that the basis of suffering is desire? Is that what the Buddha, so the basis of all suffering, wasn't that his insight?
It's tanha. It's tricky. So tanha is a sort of grasping, and there's also this thing that's called chanda, which is also a desire, but it's a desire for wholesome qualities. And so, for example, any of you that meditate here, at some place there's some chanda in there that wants to go through the sometimes painful, sort of rude process of trying to meditate when the mind is all jumpy. So that's a desire. The difference is we're looking at, it's a difference between desires that tend to tighten the mind and desires that actually tend to loosen it. And I would say eventually, all desires, including chanda, have to go. But there are a lot of them that are very skillful to actually work with for a while. And then, you know, at the higher altitudes and everything goes away. But if you try to push too much away too quickly, you know, the Buddha's always talking about a middle path. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
It does make, I mean, it makes sense. It's kind of like you're in a catch, a little bit of a catch.
Yes, yeah. Would you like to raise an objection to it?
Later.
Okay.
No, I actually didn't have much to say other than I appreciate you phrasing the Second Noble Truth around tension.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a lot of times it's translated as desire, which gets in that whole thing. And then you've got the chanda, and it's like, okay, what are they really getting at? And it's like, well, then it's translated as craving. That makes more sense to me. It kind of resonates because craving is generally viewed as a negative thing quite often. But yeah, but when you, at least for me, when I try to find it internally, it's not labeled. There's a thing there, and it's closer to tension or this like gripping.
Yeah, and you can feel sometimes it's almost like there's not much there, but a kind of a density.
Yeah.
You feel something that feels thick.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I appreciate that. I just want to express that to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amanda's got the other.
So let me say one thing more about desire.
Yeah.
That I think is very important is that it is wired into us. You know about homeostatic balances. What keeps us alive. What literally keeps us alive are all these homeostatic variables that have to be kept within a very narrow range. When you look at something like body temperature, you know, it goes out about 5 degrees and you're in bad shape, right? And so when homeostatic balance goes out, when you don't have enough nourishment, you know, or when your oxygen is low or something like that, the body will send out these really strong urges to go in that direction. So unless you want to get rid of your body, which I don't recommend, by the way, it'll happen in plenty of time all by itself, right? We have to sort of work out a relationship, you know, with all this and about really honoring it. You know, in the West, we have original sin, and in Buddhism, there's original goodness. You know, and until we can really feel what that's after, then it's hard to work with it skillfully. Because if you just get rid of the desire, well, I'll just not eat. Well, after 3 or 4 days, your stomach stops moving, so maybe, you know, your hunger pains go away, but it doesn't leave you in good shape. So, okay.
There's like 3 people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you want to start?
Sure. Is this on? Alrighty. I really appreciate also the idea of tension. I hadn't heard it really described that way before, and I really like that because, you know, yeah, you hear about grasping, attachment, and those kinds of things.
They sound moralistic, don't they?
Yes. And I think also it has to do some with how we think about things in the West, because, you know, I was raised Christian and right, like it's, you know, bad versus good. And, you know, in Buddhist psychology, anger is not a negative emotion. Sadness is not a negative emotion. They are just emotions. And I think
energy and motion.
Yeah.
Emotions.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so we kind of in the West have this sort of thing about what's negative and what's positive, and desire is negative. So anyway, I really appreciated the view of that tension also. So thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. So something I often feel challenged by is identifying when is the tension or attachment or whatever feels kind of overthought in me. When am I meant to avoid that and move away from it and just identify it and let it pass on? And when do I go underneath it and dig further? I feel like I often get confused by that question when thoughts are coming up in meditation.
Yeah, and that it's a wonderful question to have, and I don't think there's any easy answer for it. What the answer is to experiment. I'm just a strong believer in empirical trials. I have a feeling that most of this material I'm not going to get to. If I had where we end up in the end, I'll skip there. Is as your practice deepens, I think it's really important to have about 3 or 4 different practices that you are quite comfortable with, right? And so there are some practices, for example, I do a lot of objectless awareness. Objectless meditation, where you don't start off with a home base. You just start off wide open. And it's very simple, and it's extremely difficult because there's nothing to hang on to. But if you can get, you know, a little bit of that, and at the same time have other practices, like, so I can do objectless meditation, and some days it's great, and then the next day I sit down and forget it. You know, it just, there's just too much energy in the system, and they're sort of bouncing around inside. And so then I would drop back, you know, to something that's, you know, for me, I've done a lot of metta and jhana practice. So sort of dropping back to a place of just sending out kindness, you know, all directions. And that's got a little more substance to it and has, you know, so it's got a little more to hang on to. I will tell you, it's still slightly embarrassing. It was a couple of years ago, because I was doing all this advanced practice, and then I got in this place, I just couldn't do anything. You know, it was just junk, and no matter what I did. And finally I decided, I just went back to counting the breaths. I mean, that's the primitive starting place, and it felt very humbling, and I felt sort of crushed. And you know, it took about 5 minutes. And within about 5 minutes, the mind, it just settled down. It just needed me to sort of relax and be with something simple, and it quieted down. And then it went back, you know, to a different kind of practice. And I got it, you know, at that point, that we need this range of practices. And what goes along with that, that's very important, and this is just trial and error, empirical trials, is to try out different things at different times until you get a feel for what works for you. You know, in the beginning, in most meditation, the practices are pretty simple and uniform. As the practice goes deeper and deeper, what you are left to deal with and untangle is probably more and more specific to your neurosis and your background and your stuff. And nobody knows that stuff better than your system does. And it'll be a little bit different. So you have to cultivate some ways of sorting out, you know, what's useful and what's not so much at particular times.
Yeah, your teacher talks about this membrane around the brain and relaxing that. And I've never heard of that before. Where did that come from?
Yeah, I don't know. There is a membrane around the brain. There's no muscles attached to it. I think there's a subjective feel of the you know, the brain is all in a sac, you know, and there's tissue around all of that. And I'm not, I've become really interested in looking into the neurobiology of what's going on, you know, in part because in the West, that's one of our easiest tracks to selflessness. You know, we understand that good science is impersonal and meditation feels incredibly personal. So when we can see what's going on inside from an impersonal perspective, that's really helpful. So there is something that feels like there's this contraction around the outside. There are muscles and stuff around the outside of the skull. And my old psychotherapist, who was had done just about everything except for meditation, it was really brilliant. Her name for that was numbskull. And you can try this sometimes. You know, if your mind is just really off buzzing someplace, you know, just massage it, just kind of stimulate it, you know. And as it relaxes, you'll find that, oh, well, you know, some of those fuzzy thoughts start to relax as well. So I think that's what Bhante Vilmaramsi was talking, but his terminology is a little bit different.
No, I got, hold on, before. So I had a couple of observations, but I wanted to check with people online before I go. Does anyone else have a you want to take Doug down the path of some other question before I go in once? Going twice. All right, so.
You've been warned.
You've been warned, Angela will now speak. So I do want you to get back to the metaphor of high altitude meditation where the view is beautiful and the air is thin. So the process is harder. But I did want to like look at tension for a second more because while it's very interesting and a great word to use, tension doesn't exist as a thing in of itself. It's existing between me and something else, whether it's a goal or aspiration. I still think of the attachment, like I'm sitting here going, I'd really like to live forever, but I'm not attached to the outcome. You know, that's the training that I'm hearing. It's like wanting something, you know, it's okay to dissolve. To desire something, but it's what do you think will happen if you get this? That's the outcome. If you're attached to the outcome, like I was going to jokingly say, I'd really like to be married to Brad Pitt. You know, that is something that I'm feeling it, right? Mm-hmm. Is it going to happen? No, but if someone has an attachment to an outcome, if I buy this phone, if I sit for 2 hours a day, my life is going to look like XYZ. That's the tension.
Right. Right.
That's where the tension exists. It exists between why I do something and what do I expect to get. And that's at the core of the conflict of American ideals, because right. We're taught to be goal oriented. If I do X, Y, and Z, I get to buy a house, I get to do this, I get rewards. And that is, I think, why I practice is to walk away
yes.
from that the doing.
That's, yeah, okay, subtly, if you can feel that in the end, I want to be able to walk away.
Yeah,
it's got abandoning. It's got that subtle, yeah, pushing away. So there's two things. Let me just mention them so I don't forget them. One is dependent origination, and the other is what I like to call enlightened futility.
Yeah.
In Buddhism, part of the paradigm there is not going after anything directly, but seeing what the causes and conditions are. So there's this, you know, gigantic web of life, and everything is directly or indirectly related to everything else. And so if you want some peace and quiet, you can go for the peace and quiet. Or as the Buddha said, look at it, what is it that is creating the disturbance in the first place, and see if there's some way of dealing with that, which leaves the causes and conditions that create peace and quiet. Right, so it, there's always that that secondhand piece. I came up with this enlightened with an enlightened futility because I think that's the only answer to your question. You know, there'll always be this place that thinks, well, if I just do this a little bit more, or do this a little bit more, or do this a little bit more. Well, I would say just go for it. And what you'll see after a while is it just doesn't work.
Right.
It just doesn't work. And I think a sense of futility is a great motivation. You know, because otherwise we're just trying to, I won't try too hard, and maybe nobody, the Buddha won't notice that I'm really trying a little bit by that. And maybe it's not because the Buddha said anything, it's just because how it works, you know. I guess I've come up with a lot of these over the years. You know, another is, reality doesn't care. It just doesn't care. Any of you know Byron Katie?
Yeah.
So what's her phrase about that?
She has like a three-step. Is it true? Is it?
No, there was something that was quite direct. Well,
who would you be if you don't have that thought?
Right.
Right.
There's another one that says, you know, if you avoid reality, you lose, but only 100% of the time. You know?
And I do want you to come back to this high altitude, because I noticed the metaphor of thin air and beautiful views. If you think about that, that is aspirational and hard.
Yes. Yes. And the other thing that I would say about it too is that it is incredibly ordinary. 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 It just seems really simple. And we think that if we don't get it, it must be because it's really complicated. But that isn't true. So it's a matter of being skillful. So how are we doing for time here? If what I can do is I can go through those five phases of the spectrum of awareness, and that may flesh out a little bit of what you're talking to. Well, I'm skipping over my first thing, which I was really interested in, was hearing what you guys actually do in your practice. But we're getting enough of this interchange that I'll just go straight to this. So the first phase on the spectrum of awareness is content, right? And that's the evolutionary function of awareness, quite frankly. There's a bear walking down the road, you know, and so awareness is supposed to notice what's going on out there. So we don't have to train ourselves to be aware of the content. It's just there. Yeah, here it is in a schematic form. Content includes plans, stories, ideas, problems, friends, foes, things, lots of things. Okay. Now, as the mind relaxes and expands, softens and expands a little bit, what happens is the content, it doesn't disappear, but it sort of fades off into the background a little bit, up into the foothills. And we start to become aware of the processes in the mind that are generating this, right? So it's the second phase. Thinking, worrying, storytelling, planning, fighting, defending, you know, et cetera, all that stuff that we are doing. And part of the art of this is realizing that content, I used to say this is 100% truth. I'm not quite sure if it actually is. But content, I would say, is almost always in the past or the future. It's something that just happened or something we're anticipating. Processes are in the present. So if you have a rambling mind and you're sitting there trying to fight those thoughts off and trying to get it quiet down, if you just shift your focus from the contents of the thought to just be aware of the rambling, then the content begins to fade back a little bit, and you're just noticing what's in the present. Okay, so thinking, worrying, storytelling, planning, arguing, daydreaming. Not the plans, not the arguments, not the daydreaming, but the daydreaming, the planning, and the arguing. Okay, is that much clear? Okay, the third one is the qualities of awareness. As the mind continues to relax and expand, we begin to notice the qualities in the mind that are creating the processes that generate the content. We think of it as the other way around, but that's not what the causal relationship really is.
Oops.
Maybe that's, does that seem clear enough, or is that, I see some furrowed brows here and there. So those first three get subtler and subtler, but most of us are, it's very easy to recognize there's some familiarity with the first three. But they are a lot subtler, you know, as you go from phase one to two to three. As you notice the qualities of awareness, as you relax and expand into those, this is why fighting it doesn't help. As you relax and expand into those, you may start to notice the field of awareness itself. It's quite subtle. It's sort of analogous to you see a field, and rather than having your attention caught by, you know, the trees and the flowers and the plants and all that stuff, you just take in the field as a whole. Okay. Or what I used to do a lot as a kid, you know, on a clear moonless night, I would go out there and look up in the sky, you know, and there are all the stars and maybe a few planets and a derelict satellite or two. And there's all that stuff out there. But I would sort of look in the space in between. You know, it's like you're looking into infinity. So that space, one of our word for it, which is the title of my book, is presence. Presence is not a thing as much as a space within which you can experience things. Outer space is nothing. It's absolutely nothing, but without that nothing, there would be nothing in it, right? Without the field, there would be no objects within the field. And so you notice, or right now in this room, it may be a little harder at this moment, but as you walk into a room for the first time, rather than just seeing all individual people, sometimes you get a sense of the ambience, you know, of the group. There's a feel for it. So we're talking about things that are very subtle and hard to get the language for. But does it make sense what I'm talking about? Okay. So that's the field of awareness. Apart from its context and the process and qualities, or even its textures. The final one is the hardest of all of them to put your finger on, but it's the nothingness out of which everything arises. The nothingness out of which everything arises. For example, I don't know, have some of you had the experience of sitting there in meditation, and not in an extraordinary, but in a simple way, the mind is just quiet. And if you say, oh, it's quiet, well, then you've turned it into a thing and it buzzes a little bit, right? Right. But there's a sort of moment there where there's just quiet, and then it starts talking, right? And what happens, our attention gets drawn to the talking. But what I'm suggesting here is just spending a moment there to look at the emptiness out of which that stuff arose. And it's really important to understand in Buddhism that the Buddha was not a philosopher. He was a phenomenologist. He was interested in phenomena. And all the structures we put behind it, all that mental stuff, he was just not interested, because he was interested in the practical problem of how to relieve suffering. That was it. And it turns out that if we can just get clear enough to see what's going on, that is enough to mitigate the suffering. So he's looking at the phenomena here. And so there is this nothingness out of which everything arises. In formal meditation practice, it'll arise sometimes the way I said, and other times, if you've ever been sitting, this probably happens more on retreat or a longer meditation, where you're sitting there and suddenly it's like you jerk a little bit and you come back, right? And you don't know where you were, but it just feels like it feels like you nodded off and just woke up.
Or like falling?
Oh, yes. Yeah, falling is another one. There's a... if you're interested in that, let me just say again, and then help me pick this back up again. A lot of this stuff is in my book, and there's a chapter in there where I started off writing two or three common phenomena that are actually very close to Nirodha. And as I started writing down, I ended up with a list of 14 of them. Sometimes if you can notice those qualities and just kind of lean into them. But back to where I was going with this, you're sitting there meditating and it feels like you just kind of woke up or came up out of a sleep or something. And maybe did fall asleep, you know, that happens often enough. But sometimes when you come back, the mind is clear as a bell. And if you come back and the mind is fuzzy or, you know, or tight or something like that, you probably fell asleep. But if the mind is clear, you weren't asleep. What happens is perception requires a little bit of tension. So there's awareness that just happens spontaneously. And then there's awareness of this phenomena, and you compare it to that phenomena, and there's a name that you have for it. And that's what we call perception. We get a label for it. When the mind gets relaxed and expanded enough, it just gets so relaxed it just stops doing that. And you can have this funny place where it doesn't feel funny, it just feels normal, where there's a lot of awareness going on, but you're actually not perceiving things, you're not actually labeling things. That is just gone. And if you think about it, well, then you've started labeling it and they all start up again. And the other thing that happens is to take an experience and push it into our memory banks takes a little bit of tension. So as the mind, heart, expand and relax, it stops doing that. And so the subject of experience is that there's a moment ago that you've got no memory trace of. And it feels like this little blank spot. And so what do you do with that? You relax. You know, the fact that you noticed it means you probably lost it. But you notice it, you give yourself some credit for it. You know, you recognize, wow, you know, that happened seemingly by itself. You know, maybe you don't have to work as hard. You can also look at the causes and conditions. What were you doing before that led to that? So in those little blank spots, that's what the Buddha called Nirodha, cessation of perception, consciousness, and feeling. And then there will be some times where you come back and everything looks different. something has shifted. And that's the, could be the after sign of nibbana. That's what happens with nibbana. The relaxation goes so deep that some of the deep structures of how you think about stuff just lose their mooring and shift, you know, into a more healthy place. And so what do you do with that? You just keep meditating. That's the only instructions there are, is to just kind of keep going. Enjoy it. Keep going. And realize that you stumbled into something. And so it can't be that hard. Because again, I think most of the trouble we have is we try too hard. So to try to find that way to relax without going off into a thought trance. And the way you do that is to go off into a thought trance. Don't fight the trance. Don't fight it. Recognize, release it, or as they turn towards, relax into it and let it soften. You don't have to fight it. You just release the tension in it. Okay. We've got about 15 minutes left. Where do we go from here? Yeah. What I could talk a little bit about is how you meditate on various places along that spectrum of awareness.
You got someone online, Helen's.
Helen, did you want to go first, or do you want me to go?
I'm easy.
Go.
Okay.
Are you easy?
Sometimes.
Good answer.
Until I get caught up, and then I'm not. I guess, yeah, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. So when you have that moment after the fact, there's this interesting little thing of wanting to get back there.
Yes.
Any advice on, I don't know, letting that go? Not getting hung up on wanting to get back.
No. Here's the deal. Everything that comes up, you feed it back into the practice. Right? You have that lovely experience and you feel, I want more of that. And what the mind will say is, this is special. This is outside of meditation. You got to fix this one so you can get back to meditation. No. You just see that there's that little bit of grasping that has spontaneously arisen there. And you turn towards it and relax into it. And the third noble truth, which I don't think I got to before, is says Nirodha is to be realized. So the cessation is to be realized. And that confused me for a long time, but I think it's a translation problem, that realize there means make real. So if there's, and Nirodha is one way of describing it, I mean, formally is what I just said about the cessation of perception, feeling, and consciousness, but subjectively, it's just a feeling of deep equanimity. So how do you realize, how do you make real whatever that deep experience is? If there are any wholesome qualities that come up around it, you just let them soak in. You just savor the experience. And if there are not uplifted qualities, then, and this is the biggest trick of all, you just smile. You just smile. And from what we know about the neurology is that when we smile, it tends to trigger, you know, a neurological, you know, equivalent to a kind of an opening. So it just kind of propels us that way without trying for it. I have a couple of other things I do. One that I really like a lot is just a phrase that I use for that, which is, of course. Right? This thing comes up. Of course it comes up. I mean, look at what I was doing for the past 24 hours. Of course there's residual tension flowing. Of course. It's not a problem. It's just everything is working as it's designed.
That's very helpful. Thank you. One thing I've been trying to do is just remember then Nibbana is just there.
Yes.
So if you can't get back and you want to get back, it's okay, because it's still there. You're just blocking yourself. And so I've been trying to use that, but this is very helpful as well to let go and just be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Doug, last week, Risa Karazak spoke to us about the fierce spiritual activism of Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. And I know that's been dear to your life. We're learning a lot today about neurobiology and how we maneuver through the various stages of our practice in meditation. Just wondering if you can say anything about what you love about the practice that keeps you going.
Boy, I don't know. You know, I meditate probably 2 or 3 hours most days now. And I'm not saying that out of bragging or anything. I'm saying it because I'm slow. You know, I need the extra time. And the practice tends to create the background conditions under which things tend to line up. Trace the background conditions under which in which things try to line up. You know, what I would say is that the stuff that happens in meditation is not because of what we're doing; it's just because of luck. It happens out of luck, and I know the more you practice, the luckier you get. So we're just kind of creating the conditions that will allow something that's deeper and truer and realer in us to come forward and to cut through, you know, a lot of the social conditioning and the craziness and all the other stuff that's going on out there. It's a way of taking care of ourselves so that we can take better care of the world around us. You know, with a lot of the craziness, particularly the last couple of years, you know, there's a little place in me that says, maybe I should just go off into a cave someplace, you know. But I have this 2-year-old and a 5-year-old grandkid, you know, and there's nothing that pulls on my heart as much as they do. they are spunky. And so I can't turn away from all this stuff. And I can't do it by myself. But what I can do is figure out how much I can do, you know, and do that and encourage other people. And then we'll see. And we'll see.
Is there any more questions? Any other questions? Someone?
Thanks, Cedric. So I have a super crass question because I don't.
Great.
Great. Crass and awesome. Maybe just kind of ignorant because I don't have a very deep practice. But I struggle with a lot, and I'm sure you've touched on this in some indirect way. I've struggled a lot with procrastination. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a few words about that?
Pay attention to it. Pay attention to it. When it feels like you're procrastinating, take this sort of position of, I don't know what the heck is really going on here. I have lots of thoughts about what's going on, but I don't really know. How is it that I know that I'm procrastinating? What is it that I'm actually experiencing inside that gets labeled as procrastination? What are the movements in the mind? What are the feelings, et cetera, et cetera? And as always, as with all the practice, is if you notice any tension in that procrastination, you relax into it. Sometimes procrastination is, you know, part of it could be trying to give yourself some permission, you know, to go take a nap, you know? And sometimes what you really need is a nap. And sometimes, no, it gets very complicated where there's layers upon layers and stuff get all entangled. And particularly with procrastination, it can take a little time to kind of soften through and open that stuff up. But what are you going to do in the meantime? You know, to just pay attention to what's there, what the procrastination feels like. Take it into your heart. You know, a lot of this stuff we know more in our belly or more in our head, but you know, the heart is a much more integrative place. And so you take it into your heart. And I would say of all of us living in this time, you can also ask yourself, is there some grief here? Is there some grief? You know, grief. I'm sorry, you know, when we're hurting, our bodies and our psyches are designed in such a way that we're supposed to grieve. That's not a problem. It's actually part of the healing. And so, and the other thing, which gets back to dependent origination, when you look back and say, oh, I'm a procrastinator, how does that thought, how does that label feel? What kind of violence does that do to your sense of who it is underneath in the system experiencing all that stuff? And if it hurts, turn towards the hurt and relax into it. You see, I have this gift. I was chronically depressed for the first 20 or 30 years of my life. And I would see people around me who could just kind of coast over that stuff. I could never coast. I could never coast. You know, I would try to coast and I would just go, you know, down like that. And I did everything I could to fight it. And then at one point I realized I just can't. And the only thing that left was to go through it. You know, and I've got help with some good therapists, et cetera, but as I kept on going through that stuff, I just feel like that's the only place I ever got any movement. And so I began to think of myself as a kamikaze, you know, that if it hurt, I would just, because I knew doing anything else would just be a low grade grinding. Ugh. But if I went in, it would get worse, but it actually opens stuff up a lot more. So, yeah. Get help, support, come to sanghas, do all that stuff. And the only question that's important, and this is for meditation and just for our lives in general, the question that's most important is what's most real right now? And if what's real is some aching in my heart, I am not going anywhere else. I mean, I cannot go anywhere else until I open up to that. I can drag it along as a ball behind me and try to get rid of it, but I know it's gonna be there at some point, you know? So what the heck? What the heck? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Doug, for coming. It's wonderful to have you back again. Would you like to do a dedication of merit?
Sure. So let's take a moment. And just see where you are right at this moment. And be kind to yourself. Just notice what's going on without preference, without preferences. And then letting your awareness come into your heart. And just see what's there. And if you do that, you know, eventually you notice the heart wants to expand. It just wants to flow out. So you tap into that, and if it's not there obvious, you know, you can just do it with subtle phrases. Wishing well to those people who are sitting right around you or in this room with you. May you be happy. May you know the deepest kind of a peace. May you know the truth of your true nature. And then sending all that out beyond these walls to the people and the squirrels and the birds and the traffic. May all beings know true happiness, simple happiness. May all beings find sources of contentment and aliveness and joy and, yes, love. And then sending that out way beyond, all around the planet, all the suffering that's out there. May all beings see the truth of who they really are. May all beings know freedom. May all beings know ease. May it be so. Blessed be. Namaste.